and welcome to the Trash Tapes Podcast as part of the Enigmatic Productions Network. If you love bad cinema and incredible deep dives into cult film, then you have come to the right place. So if you like what you hear and want to support us, you can do so by donating some funds to our Buy Me a Coffee website, along with the Acast supporter feature. All of these can be found in the description below. And now, on with the show.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Movie buffs and cinephiles, and welcome to another episode of the Not So Trash Reviews. My name is Johan Chapal, your host, amateur sleuth, and someone who's been listening to way too many true crime podcasts lately. On this episode, I'm joined by actor and YouTuber Chris Chambers as we review a film which at first I thought was a little too mainstream for the podcast, since we usually go for cult cinema and misunderstood gems. But it's the latter that I decided to jump on. Looking at David Fincher as a director, there are many films that get the praise and admiration they rightly deserve, but our film rarely gets discussed as much in comparison to the rest of his filmography. Even Alien 3 and The Curious Case of Benjamin Button have had some discourse about them due to their novelty and production history. So with that being the curio, I accepted his request and re-watched it after many years. I found it almost as a rediscovery, planting seeds of what could be the director's visual language and some of the best performances of what would now be considered the biggest actors in Hollywood. So while this film may be talked about in some circles, when was the last time you watched it? Does it still hold up? We're about to uncover this mystery and find the clues as to why this film may in fact be Fincher's best. So, join Chris and I as we examine the development of performance and style, the 2007 mystery thriller biopic, Zodiac.
Dear editor, this is the murderer of the two teenagers last Christmas at Lake Herman and the girl on the 4th of July.
I want you to print this cipher on the front page of your paper.
He wants his code in the afternoon edition.
Ray Smith, don't you have a cartoon to finish?
The Zodiac Killer has come to San Francisco.
Another letter.
School children make nice targets.
He gave himself a name.
Greek, Morse code, astrological signs. This guy's used them all.
I like killing people because man is the most dangerous animal of all.
How does one do that?
I like puzzles. I do them a lot.
Got any hard suspects?
About 90 an hour. I'm up to around 500.
You got four crime scenes. Not a single usable print. You can't think of this case in normal police terms.
He's breaking the pattern.
Lena said you were a cartoonist.
Oh, yeah.
What are you doing at a gun range?
I just want to help.
What are you, some kind of Boy Scout?
Eagle Scout, actually. First class.
Well, I've been thinking.
Oh, God, Sam, what's the rule?
There's no evidence, Robert.
What do you mean there's no evidence? You have him seen with the ciphers, the military boot prints, the bloody knife.
All circumstantial.
Why do you need to do this?
Because nobody else will.
Dave, you made a mistake!
Get away from the window.
Paul, are you okay?
No.
Why'd you do it? You put your face out there for him to see.
Hello? Who is this?
Zodiac was my job. It is not yours.
He's still out there, Dave.
Killing is his compulsion. It drives him. It's in his blood.
She's
What?
Squirrels.
This is the Zodiac speaking.
I have a gun.
I can give you a lift to the service station.
Do you always go around helping people in the night?
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
And I am joined here by Chris. Hi there.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm very well, mate.
Superb. I've been wanting to have you. I haven't spoken to you in a while, to be frank. So it's quite nice to get you on here. And I wanted to get you on the show for predominantly because I wanted to talk about some movies from an actor's perspective in particular, because most of the people I know are filmmakers, right? I don't know a lot of actors. And I find wanting to analyze a cult film or a movie that needs a little bit more love and attention from an actor's perspective could be quite an interesting approach.
Well, I mean, it's always good to get a different viewpoint.
Indeed. And that's the main goal I wanted to go for that today. Now you suggested this film, and on first glance, I kind of thought you might have missed the mark a bit, because I thought this is originally thinking, because you said, like, okay, I want to do a David Fincher film. I go, like, David Fincher's quite a well-known director, so why are we going this route? Until you mentioned the movie Zodiac. And I thought, well, I thought everyone knows Zodiac. Oh, everyone knows Zodiac's a great movie. Until I sat there and I found a few things that kind of tickled me a bit. Number one, I forgot pretty much that anything that happened in Zodiac at all. I've completely forgot about it. But secondly, how difficult it is to find. It's not on any streaming service unless you pay for it. The DVDs are kind of not around. You can't really buy them about. And it just kind of feels like it's not something that a lot of people, it's not a movie in his collection that people talk about. So
that's why I love it. Yeah, it's sort of his underdog film. You know, when you say David Fincher, people think of Seven, they think of Fight Club. But, you know, this film, maybe some people don't know about it, or I would possibly argue that they just don't like it because it's different to what he's done before of that genre.
You know what I actually find more interesting, actually? This is the thing I approach, because I literally, this is very fresh for me. I've literally just rewatched it hours before seeing you. And the more I kept watching it, the more I didn't think, like, I don't think people didn't like it. I think people missed a mark when it came out. Because if this is, I will quintessentially say, is the most David Fincher film in the history of David Fincher films. It, in terms of his style, his aesthetic, his form of direction, the way he shoots, the way he edits, this is everything that a David Fincher fills under. Movies before then, so if you look at things like Panic Room, Fight Club, Seven, they're all testing the waters. It hasn't been fully finalized yet. But then everything after Zodiac all feel like they've David Fincher's finally mastered his craft of how he approaches a movie. And if you look at the best example I can think of right now is looking at Mindhunter, the TV series. It's exactly like Zodiac in its approach.
Yes, you took the words right out of my mouth. I was just about to say that. I mean, it's got very much of that ilk, that television show, in terms of the pace for me. The pace is a lot slower. It's a lot more character driven. So yeah, it's a really good point. I never thought about it like that. Yes, he is almost testing the waters, really, with those earlier films.
And yeah, and then from this point onwards, other films are falling the similar ilk. Like if you look at his remake of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, if you look at a little bit on Social Network, he's finally found a thing he feels comfortable with as an auteur. And I was thinking, like, I've seen this before. I've seen this structure before. And it turns out this is what he's mastered it. And so now every movie, even though he's created what's been now established as the David Fincher style of filmmaking. And Zodiac was his first full-blown proper attempt at this is the kind of movie I want to make from now on. Welcome to the Enigmatic Insert, where I take you aside and help analyze any key terms or theories we may stumble upon in our review. During our discussion, Chris and I began to examine the term auteurism, and if the theory can indeed apply to various roles on the film set and not just a director. However, we are going to start with our filmmaker. Is David Fincher an auteur? auteur literally translates from French to the word author, establishing that within context of cinema, the director, having exerted a high level of creative control across many aspects of the film, can imprint a distinct style, theming, and message that's predominantly theirs. The term was first used in a 1954 essay, A Certain Trend in French Cinema, written by director and film critic François Truffaut, who would later be considered the grandfather of French New Wave. He stated that filmmakers who make an effort to impose a unique and personal vision onto their work will stand out from the mere stager directors of the ever-churning mainstream studio films. Like painters and authors, they would have created something that would be considered their own and influence others after them. So how can we define what makes an auteur filmmaker? Andrew Sarris, film critic for the New York Times, expanded on the definition with three components. Auteurs need to show a sense of technical competence in their filmmaking skills. They have a distinguishable personality presented onto the screen that cannot be mistaken for any other filmmakers. And auteurs make films that can have layers of meaning with themes and messages that only they have a distinct interest in. Does Fincher fall into this? Through that definition, it is a resounding yes. His films do have a very exact technique, have very particular color palettes, tropes, and stories that can almost be mimicked to be used the term Fincher-esque. Look at the most recent Matt Reeves film, The Batman, has actually been compared and described as such. But this is not something that Fincher had from the beginning of his career or created entirely on his own. It was developed and influenced with every production and with every person he ended up regularly working with. The flaw with auteur theory is the lack of consideration for others in the production and the collaborative effort filmmaking is. Fincher has worked with a series of regulars such as composer Trent Reznor, cinematographer Jess Cronenworth, editor Angus Wall, and of course, his wife and regular producer, Cian Chaffin. This is clearly an ongoing team effort that helped make creative style a reality. Chris Chambers begins to examine how Zodiac might be a turning point for Fincher, comparing it to his other previous works like Seven. I'll let him explain.
I mean, I find it interesting that he makes this film after something like Seven, for instance, which you could say is the quintessential, you know, serial killer horror film, you know, of that ilk, that genre. And I can imagine, I mean, maybe me saying, oh, they just didn't like Zodiac, maybe that's a bit strong, but I can imagine someone going from Seven to Zodiac and expecting the same thing and just being completely shocked or turned off. Because it's, I mean, I don't know how much of a deep dive you want to go into the film right now and the plot, but it's a film without much of a resolution, which I find really interesting. Again, we're talking about some of, you know, an actor's point of view, that you have these characters with an arc, but no real resolution. Because obviously we're dealing with, you know, the real life story of the Zodiac where they never actually caught the killer.
Yeah.
So it's more an examination, less about the Zodiac killer, but about the people involved, everyone from the police to investigative journalists to the people on the street of San Francisco. You know, how do they get some resolution when this person's never been caught?
Yeah.
And that's what I find fascinating, especially just as a storytelling device. And that's why I see it as a kind of a night and day thing between Seven and Zodiac.
What I find interesting is, like, if you look at his previous films before Zodiac, like Panic Room, examples, another one, he's experimenting a lot more creatively with things like camera, like moving camera, things going through walls. He's using a lot of CGI to be more creative in that sense,
which turns me off, I've got to say. Still to this day, when I watch Panic Room and you see that virtual camera going through keyholes and up shafts, it turns me off. I mean, I know he's always experimented with that, but there's something that's a little, again, you like you were saying, he was testing the water, really. But yeah, for me, that's when he was really pushing it and it was getting in the way of telling the story.
Yeah, because if you look at the same kind of camera techniques happen in Fight Club. These two things happen to say in these two movies. And it's almost like he's thinking, like, is this how I play with a camera? Is this how I do this? Turns out, no, because in all the other movies since then, he barely does this virtual camera thing. he's mastered the color palette, which is all his movies have a very similar color palette that starred directly even from Alien 3. You have to forget he also directed Alien 3, even though he did not. I don't know whether he, cause it, this was the, that was the first time he probably directed a feature film, I assume, was it? I think
he's directing commercials and music videos. So he directed Janie's Got a Gun by Aerosmith.
Damn.
Which is a great music video in itself.
Yeah.
It's about a young girl that kills her father and goes on the run from the police, but it's very Fincher-esque.
Mm.
Very.
So, yeah, maybe there's a thing that he's mastered the colour palette, which he's, in Seven, that's his colour palette. He's mastered that. But he still doesn't not show how to direct and frame things just right. He's doing things and testing out the waters, but he hasn't done it. He goes to Fight Club, where it's like, okay, let's go a bit mad with it, and it's a more creative movie out of the lot, I think. Moves on to then to Panic Room, and they say like, let's do a medium-ish thing. Doesn't really work. So after that goes, you know what, fudge it. I really wanted to make Zodiac as something that he always wanted to do, because he always loved the idea of like this boogeyman story. And he's been hounding this down for a long time to do it. And so this is his passion project. This is kind of like his film, this thing. This is the most me I can possibly be. To the original thing, that apparently the original script was about 200 pages worth.
Wow.
And it's funny, I read a little bit of feedback on this. We're going to talk about the direction and the acting in a moment, actually.
Yeah.
But in order to not make it feel like it's going to be, because on average a script is about a page a minute, right? So 200 minutes.
Supposedly,
supposedly, although it varies.
That's a cliche.
It's a cliche.
There was a cliche, a filmmaking cliche. It's that.
It's that. But he actually told the actors, like, just so it can not feel like a 200-page script, the original cut of it, the original script, shooting script anyway, to tell everyone to speak a little bit faster.
I was just about to say that as a joke, but is that the truth?
Yes.
Interesting.
He's actually directed them to say, like, speak a little bit faster. Although I think he was referencing, when he was doing this, similar movies of that kind of feel, like All the President's Men, and looking at things such, and looking at those, like, those fast-talking press movies you see in the 40s and 50s where, with Cary Grant just talking his mouth off.
Yes.
Like a mile a minute.
I'm getting married, Walter, and I'm also getting as far away from the newspaper business as I can get.
What?
I am through.
You can marry all you want to, Hildy, but you can't quit the newspaper business.
Oh, well, why not?
I know you, Hildy. I know what quitting would mean to you.
And what would it mean?
It would kill you.
You can't sell me that, Walter Byrne.
Who says I can't? You're a newspaper man.
That's why I'm quitting. I want to go someplace where I can be a woman.
You mean be a traitor?
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that I was taught when I was first taught about film acting. Talk fast, move slow.
Really?
Yes.
So is that a useful piece of advice, or is that not?
I guess in terms of, I mean, I'm getting really into acting now. Mm. In terms of moving, getting out of a chair, yes, you want to, the camera's got to catch that movement. And like you said, if you've got to get through the text. So yes, in a way that is a bona fide acting technique for film. But yeah, just, I never realized that about Fincher, because, you know, I've always seen him as quite methodical in the way he makes film.
Mm.
And obviously, in terms of his camera moves, you know, we're talking about someone getting out of a chair and walking out of a door.
Mm.
The camera is usually moving with the action. You know, it's very well orchestrated. And so I just had in my head, he would be far more, I don't want to say plodding, but he would take his time with the performance and the dialogue. It's not something I can imagine Fincher saying to his actors.
Yeah, but I wouldn't be surprised. He probably was saying it, but I don't think he was saying it more like, come on, we've got to get through this quickly. I think he was saying like, look,
time is money.
Let's move on to pace, I think. This is probably the most interesting thing about the movie for me. I think we might have maybe some different approaches to this. So rewatching this, I find it interesting. The movie is long. The movie is about 2 hours and 40 minutes long. It's a long movie. There was an original cut of 3 hours and 8 minutes, which was trimmed down.
Yeah.
And to me, even though it was a long movie and there were moments where things slowed down and calm, I found the pacing of the film in a good way. Like, this is fantastic, because it never felt like 2 hours and 40 minutes. It keeps going to the point where there's so much information thrown at you at the screen.
Yes.
That, and this is wonderful, by the way, it makes you feel like you're getting with the case, almost like you are the investigative journalist learning all this info. Because if you stopped and went for a bathroom break and came back and missed 10 minutes, you've missed an entire, almost in some cases, a year.
I mean, there's some fantastic montages in the movie, you know, when you've got, through the eyes of the journalists getting the letters. In terms of Jake Gyllenhaal's character, Robert Graysmith, you know, his investigating this, like you just said, there's so much there, especially delivered through the montages, that it doesn't feel like a slow movie at all. I mean, that surprised me a little bit that you just said it was, what did you say, 2 hours, 40 minutes?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, this movie is actually a favourite of mine and my partner's. We watch this film all the time. Mm. We'll always stick it on. She's a big fan of the whole true crime serial killer. She's always listening to these podcasts. But we, you know, one of us will always say, do you fancy watching Zodiac? Yes, stick Zodiac on. We keep coming back to this film. And there's just something about it. Like I say, it's fascinating because it's a true story. Mm. But I just love the way it's told. It's a character-driven film.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about, I mean, obviously I don't want to get into the acting just yet. But, I mean, think about how much of the actual Zodiac is in there. You know, there's maybe 3 or 4 scenes of murders. The rest is these characters working it out, working their way through this world.
And the murders are all within the first hour or so.
Yeah.
Like, all the bits that you might sell a murder mystery on is like, you're going to watch all the murders. You're going to watch all the gruesome, gory deaths, right? It's part of its selling point. It's only in the first hour of this nearly 3-hour film. The other 2 hours have barely anything to do with the killer himself.
Yes, which is incredible. I mean, if you or I were to make that story and we say, oh, by the second hour, there's no more Zodiac, how do you write something like that? You know, the house of cards just tumbling in. I mean, it's fantastic.
This is the Zodiac speaking. I am the murderer of the taxi driver over by Washington Street and Maple Street last night. Prove this here is a blood-stained piece of his shirt. I am the same man who did in the people in the North Bay area. The SF police could have caught me last night if they had searched the park properly instead of holding road races with their motorcycles.
Gentlemen.
Dave.
Paul, where's his shirt?
Right there, boss.
There's your rag the kids talked about.
So you got in the front seat to tear up a piece of the shirt?
Is this on the record?
What do you think?
He confirms the Vallejo and Napa killings.
Gets worse.
Robert, you have a deadline?
What does he mean, it gets worse?
Read the last part.
School children make nice targets. I think I shall wipe out the school bus some morning, just shoot out the front tire, and then pick off the kiddies as they come bouncing out. Jesus Christ, who's got school buses? Department of Transportation?
School board.
All right. I'm going to need elimination prints from your staff. Is anyone here didn't touch this letter?
But who actually cracked the code? A married couple who like puzzles. So what's that tell us about the Zodiac?
He's no expert.
Right, it's just a simple substitution code like the one that we used to do as Boy Scouts. A is 1, B is 2.
We weren't all Boy Scouts, Robert.
Well, it's not that hard. You just gotta know where to start, though. Getting the first cipher.
You actually carry that around with you?
Why?
No reason.
What's the most common double consonant in the English language?
Consonant?
The double L.
Double L.
And what's the one word that we know that he'll use in here at least once?
Kill.
Right, kill. So the Hardens start looking for double symbols, which they find here, here, and here, each with the same two symbols preceding them. So now they've got a repeating four-letter word ending with two symbols that they assume stand for L.
And since I think the whole word is kill.
Then. And you got the K, you got your I, and you're on your way.
But how do you go from A as 1 and B as 2 to figuring out this whole cut?
Well, same way I did. You go to the library. In this book, the author presents a very simple substitution code in the preface. 8 of the 26 symbols that he suggests are found in this cipher.
But there are non-letter symbols, because there's all these medieval ones.
I thought they looked medieval, too. But then I found a code written in the Middle Ages. Guess what it's called? The Zodiac Alphabet.
Jesus.
What do you want out of this?
What?
What's your angle? This is good business for everyone but you.
How do you mean business?
It shows how much it adds more to the mythos. And what I find fascinating with this movie is that it really builds more on this boogeyman mythos thing and almost feeling as if it's like, you may have caught him, and this whole idea with having Arthur Lee being the possible killer, turning out at the very end on a goddamn text crawl at the very end of the movie, yes, saying like, due to forensics, turns out it's not him. And you're like, wow, okay. Yeah. So we've been almost gaslit, just like a little bit like Jake Gyllenhaal's character is semi-gaslit throughout the movie, thinking you're going nuts.
Yeah, which I can imagine, you know, your average moviegoer would hate something like that, you know. They want the, you know, the big reveal, who done it, you know, and you don't get that.
You don't get that big final hurrah, and it does end on a dour note. But I think this movie isn't about the ending. The movie is about the journey you get there, and it's a fantastic roller coaster, fast pace, like intense movie where you're on three different roller coasters at once, because you've got the investigative journalists, you got their arcs, you've got the police's arcs, you've got the people, all the witnesses' arcs. They're all going up and down, and you're trying to almost catch up with it. You do end up wishing you had a board with red rope trying to connect everything and going like, is that it? I don't know.
Yeah. And maybe that's one of the reasons why, you know, me and my partner Neve go back to this film all the time, because we're discovering more and more about it, you know. And it does open up a lot of discussions between us. I mean, obviously, she knows a lot more than I do about this subject. But, yeah, I think you get something out of this film every time you watch it. It's worth revisiting. I mean, how did you feel? Well, you have seen this film before today.
Yeah.
So what did you think about it when you revisited it? I mean, on a base level, did you enjoy it?
I loved it, to the point that I was generally surprised that I didn't have a DVD of it, because I thought, like, I have a massive DVD collection and Blu-ray collection. I sat there going like, oh, I must have this somewhere, because if I really liked the movie, or if I remember the movie, I'd buy it. Yeah. It's not my collection, and it really confused me. So I went to go online and try to find online. Really difficult to find online unless you have to pay for something like four quid for a rental. And so I was like, then it must be on somewhere. It's a big popular movie by the sound of thing. It has to be. Couldn't. So I had to go, not entirely legal means, I will say that frankly, to find this film. And that shows like that already kind of already set up the idea, like, this already surprises me that it's taken me so many loops to get there. By the time I got there, it was worth it, because I barely remembered a thing. And that's really strange for a David Fincher film, because you honestly feel like, I would remember this more. And I think it's mostly because, like I was saying at the beginning, Zodiac is almost like the ultimate David Fincher blueprint. And so it's his first attempt at it. So me watching that, I don't think it clicked. Now that he's made so many other movies afterwards, almost following, almost to a T, this template, it made me realize, going, so this is where it all started.
Yeah.
This is where the Fincher style really got cemented. And it's been overshadowed by other films and TV shows that he's been on, that he's worked on. And you know, it almost felt like a wonderful surprise going through all this again and going like, so that's the thing here. This is the thing here. That's the thing there. Everything clicked for me. And I honestly now feel like this is now one of my favorite Fincher films, because it, just rewatching it going like, this is great. Why have I felt genuinely in awe as to how this flew by me.
I'm dying to talk about the acting, Johan. Can you tell? I'm chomping at the bit to talk about the acting.
So, you know what? Yeah. So, you know what? Let's talk about that. Let's talk about the direction and the acting in this film. Okay.
Sure.
So, I want you kind of maybe, because you've seen enough David Fincher films by this point to kind of suss out if whether or not he has, at least in terms of his cast, does he have a particular, do you think he has a very particular way of directing actors?
He seems to always get actors who know how to do their job. I mean, I wonder if I mean, I don't want to compare him to someone like Ridley Scott, you know, who is famous for saying, I employ actors so they can do their goddamn job and act, and I don't have to worry about that. But, you know, going back to the whole Fincher technical thing and how technical his movies are and his camera shots and his camera moves and his blocking, I don't know. I could just imagine that he perhaps leaves them to it, you know, on the whole.
It does feel like he has always, whether it's him or a casting director, just knows exactly who needs to play these roles.
Yes, yeah.
Every movie I've ever seen of his has never been, I've never sat down going, this is poorly miscast. Other than the only one movie in David Fincher's arsenal, which is very different, which is The Curious Case of Benjamin Button, where that is a full-blown outlier in his entire canon of style, because it's a very different movie. It's fantasy. And even when he's trying to apply all his tones to it, it doesn't work because the movie's a bit more uplifting.
Almost as if he is trying to sing for his supper, you know, that he's doing that movie as a, you know, as a favor.
Almost, because he cast people which I didn't think really worked in that movie, and that's why I always feel a bit off. Brad Pitt being that role didn't really work for me in that movie. But every other movie since then, and even the movies before then, he knows the people are suited for it. So perhaps he says, because I've already got you as a perfect actor for this role, because you know your research, you know what you're doing. It means that he can focus on the technical side in terms of at least blocking, movement, and things like that, rather than perhaps how the actors project their lines and how they perform, because they say, I hired you for this role for a particular reason. And I think this is why, I think his direction's quite interesting. He always seems to get, he just knows the right actor to fit.
Yes. Well, I mean, if you've seen Zodiac, you know the character that Robert Downey Jr. is playing. And you know that he's got the life experience to play that character. You don't need to direct it without spoiling what happens in the movie. You know that Robert Downey Jr. is going to be able to play Paul Avery very well.
Paul Avery as a character is absolutely phenomenal. And it's a shame, oddly enough, that he's obviously, because the movie isn't, the movie's technically about him, but also isn't about him, which in that it's not really a role where I could say who is our main piece, because it's really much an ensemble piece where even though Jake Gyllenhaal is the one we follow the most, it's an ensemble piece, and all the players around him are the ones influencing the movie, especially in the first half of the film before Graysmith goes literally on his own kind of thing. Having someone like Paul Avery is absolutely, he's actually a breath of fresh air in comparison to the rest of the characters.
Yes, I mean, at first he's just presented as the comic relief until you understand that there's something more tragic going on there. I mean, this goes back to my point about, you know, what happens to characters when they've got no, you know, there's no finality, there's no conclusion.
Welcome. Please put your stuff down. You're going down 5 rows and left, looking for the Modesto B from March.
I'm going to stand here and attempt not to vomit.
What am I looking for?
Kathleen Johns. Also probably want to pull the cron from, you know, never mind.
I'll see to that.
Okay, look at this letter again, the part about Kathleen Johns. Tell me what facts he gives.
A woman and her baby abducted.
Fact.
The car on fire.
Okay, now. Look at the article from the B. See it yet?
Everything in the letter already appeared in the article.
And he's done it before. Officer Richard Ratatich shot sitting in his car.
Zodiac claimed that he shot someone in their car.
A couple days after this article came out, the police already had somebody in custody. Zodiac didn't do it, but took credit for it anyway, because he's in it for the press. He even stole his symbol.
What?
Yeah. He stole his logo off a watch.
How can somebody who's killed 13 people?
He claims he's killed 13 people, but which ones can we actually confirm? There's 3 in Vallejo, 1 in Berryessa, the cabbie, that's it. Bobby, you almost look disappointed.
In terms of Paul Avery, who is this character that is almost feeding off the sensationalism of this serial killer, and it slowly starts to eat him alive to the point where he is completely cut off. Well, he's cut himself off from everyone, you know. And he's the final scene that you see him, and he's just a shell. because this whole mythology, this whole journey has just used him up.
Yeah. He feels like he's actually at that point emotionally and physically done. And yes. Physically done as well, because the last shot of Robert Downey Jr., he's in a bar somewhere, I think he is. But
he's on his boat, isn't he? He's living on a houseboat on his own with Pong playing on the TV. Do you remember? Pong, yeah. Just old fashioned Pong going boom, 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 boom.
And I love that because it's not playing with anything. Nothing's moving. There's no computer on. He's just playing. He's playing in the background because I assume he just likes the sound. But it's fascinating because by that point, he literally says it's been 4 years. Get over it. Because But realistically, he sat there going like, well, you're the reason why I've been waiting for you to come and revitalize me. But realistically, you haven't. You've actually just brought back an old wound and I am ready for it.
I mean, Robert Graysmith says, do you want to come and help me with this? He's writing a book, isn't he? He's like, do you want to come and help me co-write this book? And I suppose as a part of, Paul Avery, that's just saying, I don't want this anymore. You know, this is what has ruined... Well, I've ruined myself, but this has been the catalyst for me ruining myself. And now you're trying to open up this old wound. I'd rather just, be here, rot and die.
So, what's new?
I've been thinking.
Yeah.
Somebody should write a book.
Somebody should write a fucking book, that's for sure. About what?
About Zodiac.
That's not new.
I've been thinking that if you put all the information together, maybe you could jog something loose. And then I was thinking that nobody knows the case better than you.
Yeah, that's
true. And you know all the players, and you have all the files.
Lost them.
You lost them?
Or I tossed them. I don't know, I moved onto a boat. You know that we work in the daily business, right? As in today. What do you think we were doing back then? Do you know that more people die in the East Bay commute every 3 months than that idiot ever killed? He offed a few citizens, he wrote a few letters, and he faded into footnote. Not that I haven't been sitting here idly waiting for you to drop by and reinvigorate my sense of purpose. It's 4 years ago, let it fucking go.
You're wrong. It was important.
Then what did you ever do about it? If it was so fucking important, what did you ever do? You hovered over my desk. You stole from wastebaskets. Am I being unkind? Oh, that's right. I forgot. You went to the library.
I'm sorry I bothered you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I think in terms of, if you want to call something method acting, it's this performance from Robert Downey Jr.
Mm.
Everything from the scene where they go for drinks and they have those big blue cocktails, and the way he's got his head laying on the table and he's just looking at the drink, to the final scene when he's just a shell, and he's living on his own and he's, just had so much drugs and drink that he's just numb. He has to be using what has happened to him before that. I mean, that is emotion memory. That is sense memory at its finest. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what I love about this era of Robert Downey Jr. Like you said, it was a renaissance. But I mean, this is before all the Marvel, the Marvel growth, or the Marvel explosion, I should say.
Yeah.
And to see him experimenting in the 2000s with different movies I love that era of Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, he was experimenting with stuff as well. I remember another movie I saw beforehand. It's not a great movie, but he's best thing in it. I saw Gothica. I remember Gothica.
Oh yeah,
which is the kind of rubbish Halle Berry film. But he's the bit I remember the most in. He is trying to just say like, right, I don't know what I am, so I'm going to just put myself in most of these roles some of them honestly feel a little bit semi-biographical, because he was also working, he also did A Scanner Darkly around his time as well.
And Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. Yeah, which is about the you know, the seedy underbelly of California, you know, and being out of work as an actor, which again, there you go. That's Robert Downey Jr. before that period.
If that's not more on the nose, I don't know what is.
Exactly, exactly.
About his career.
Kursk.
Yeah.
Paul, I've been thinking.
Oh, God, save us all.
The letter to Melvin Belli was sent exactly 1 year after the Lake Herman Road murder, and the one to Sherry Jo Bates' father was sent exactly 6 months after her death. Mm. She was killed a day before Halloween, and you received a Halloween card.
You know, these are all fascinating pieces of minutiae, Robert. It's a bit early in the day.
Paul, it's 11 o'clock, and we missed editorial.
Sorry, I didn't mean to wake you up.
It's fascinating, basically, looking back. Like you said, like, this is Robert Downey Jr. for a period of time using his own experiences to try and see if he can reflect that into his career. Because I think, you know, he had a rough patch, and he's maybe trying to get back into the scene, but he's already got, at this moment in time, he's not been known as this. I can argue he's not someone you would at the time put in front of a poster, only put his name on it and sell a movie. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So he'd had to say, right, if I'm going to be doing bit characters or side characters, I want them to be interesting.
Yes.
And he nails this here with Paul Avery.
And he's probably said to himself, use what you know.
Mm.
You've gone through these life experiences, use it. So I'd like to think that he snapped up that character.
Just so, like, this is, yeah, I'm going to grab
this
instantly.
I'm having that.
goes to Fincher, saying, like, look, I know you tried for this one, but I want this.
Please. I'm here.
You were right, by the way. You didn't give his name.
Who cracked it?
A history teacher and his wife, Salinas.
I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest, because man is the most dangerous animal of all. To kill something gives me the most thrilling experience. It is even better than getting your rocks off with a girl. The best part of it is that when I die, I will be reborn in paradise. Then all that I have killed will become my slaves. I will not give you my name, because you will try to slow down or stop my collecting of slaves for my afterlife.
He thinks our friend's a tad bit fucker in the head. I heard even sent Vallejo a code key just to help.
What is that at the bottom?
Leftovers, maybe an anagram. How does one do that?
I like puzzles. I do them a lot.
How did you know he wasn't going to give his name?
Dangerous animal. Dangerous animal.
I want to discuss Jake Gyllenhaal in this movie.
Yes.
Is he the protagonist of the film?
I guess on a surface level, yes. Mm. You know, you see him starting off, you know, low level. He's an artist, isn't he? He's a cartoonist. Yeah. Starting off in the lower ranks, moving up a little bit, cracking the case. No, he never cracks the case, but, you know, trying to crack the case, talking to police. Meeting his beau, having children, boy gets girl, boy loses girl, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
But it's only on a surface level, like you say, it's maybe it's not even an ensemble piece. There's something else there. It's more about the mythology being bigger than anything else.
Yeah.
It's about the mythology of this Zodiac killer. And I think we follow Jake Gyllenhaal's character, Robert Graysmith. We follow him. As a kind of a thread throughout it, but I wouldn't say he is the protagonist.
Yeah, because he only becomes more essential near the last hour of the film. Every other time, he's purposely like a background character that just seems to, I just like puzzles, and he's slowly seething in and helping out. But realistically, is more, I'd say, one we get more interest in and more of an arc in and following the case is Mark Ruffalo.
Well, what I was about to say was, I think Jake Gyllenhaal's character actually helps introduce us as the audience to these other characters.
Mm.
He's the conduit.
His performance is interesting because I'm not sure, because obviously the people who were alive at the time and still going around, you know, would talk to Fincher and talk to everybody else, and they were, a lot of them were consultants in the movie and so on, and Grace Smith was one because obviously Grace Smith wrote the book and everything else. I'm wondering how, by that point, when you are trying to portray a role of someone who's already still alive and is a real person, how much do you try and want to be as authentic to the real person, or how much do you feel like you have to do your own spin on things? Because is Jake Gyllenhaal's performance as Gray Smith, I find quite interesting, but I'm not entirely sure what he's trying to pull across, other than just being like he's obviously by the end of the movie he just becomes purely blown obsessive to the point of ruining nearly everything around him. Yeah. But before then, he's just a little bit. People call him, he's a Boy Scout, basically.
Mm. I mean, one argument would be to say that Jake Gyllenhaal is just doing his kooky acting.
Mm.
You know? I mean, if you want to be completely disrespectful.
That's fine, that's fine.
Because, I mean, he does kooks very well. Don't get me wrong. He does kooky very well.
So, it's time to go for a detour, and let's return to auteur theory, but with a different question. Can actors be considered auteurs? Films can be marketed in different ways, such as from the producers behind a successful franchise, or the latest film from an auteur filmmaker. But then, could you consider actors whose name might carry a similar autorial weight? British scholar Richard Dyer believes that the central point of the actor auteur is one that is in control of their screen image, brand, and career pathway that creates a very distinct type of performance almost exclusively to them, which in itself can be a selling point. They are the ones that almost create a whole subgenre of films and produce a type of performance that's almost expected from them. So, consider actors who are known for very intense acting practices, like Nicolas Cage or Al Pacino, or those with meticulous choices of role, like Daniel Day-Lewis, or actors who have a very close working relationship with directors of whom they choose to work with, like Bill Murray with Wes Anderson. So when we were joking that Jake Gyllenhaal does kooky acting well, could that be his form of acting in an auteur kind of fashion? Stars can be hired exactly for having a particular method. They may be told to, or may have chosen themselves to do these roles because it's the best fit. But does it mean it is the best for the story? Do you want to be accurate to the role, or do you want to follow the brand of acting you've become accustomed to? Chris attempts to answer this question.
Answer to your question, I mean, coming from someone that's been to a Stanislavskian school, which mm-hmm. is all about understanding your character, their backstory, where they are, where they're going, what they want. If you're playing a real life character, then yes, you need to use everything that's there. You need to play that character, you know, as truthfully to how they really were.
Mm. So it's interesting then, because I always wondered that, because obviously in like biopics or anything of that ilk, or anything based on true events, there are always going to be real people, right? There are always real people involved, and some of them are still alive, which makes it even more interesting. But the idea is that does authenticity sometimes hold back in terms of performance to the narrative of a film? If it is a narrative, whether it's realistic or not, there will be some dramatization, there will be things that are not authentic. So does that give you a little leeway of having maybe your own approach to things? So you mentioned already, Jake Gyllenhaal has a quirky approach, which he does, you know, you've seen a little bit of that in things like Donnie Darko, you've seen that in Nightcrawler. So is he just applying this meld of quirky to this role, or is that just based on authenticity?
I'll be honest, I don't know much about the real life character. Mm. I haven't seen any footage of this character. But I think in answer to your question, if you were playing that character as authentically as possible, and you had a 300 page script, you would need to dial some of that down.
Yeah.
You would be getting in the way if you're going full blown method.
Mm. So in other words, then you want to be as authentic as possible, but never to the point where you're almost completely lost through that, I guess.
It's a Fincher film. You can't mess with the master.
There.
you can't get in the way.
David Fincher goes over and says, like, look, calm yourself. Calm yourself.
Who do you think you are?
You sure you don't want the car, Bill? It's your turn. You can just drop me off at my place and take the car.
You should keep the car.
Yeah?
I'm not coming in tomorrow.
What's up?
I'm done. I put in for a transfer.
Where?
Looking at fraud. I can't be on call anymore. I want to see these kids grow up.
Man, good for you, Bill.
You'll be okay.
Yeah, I'll be fine.
Hey, I'm not leaving you holding the bag on anything, am I?
No.
Okay.
Hey, you know what? Maybe have a chance to try your Japanese food, the raw stuff.
Well, I mean, for me, there's so many breakdowns of relationships in this film. Mm. In terms of what's this character named? Ruffalo's Inspector Toshi? That's his name, isn't it?
Toshi,
Toshi. He loses his partner.
Mm.
So his partner doesn't die, you know, not in a 7-esque way. His partner isn't killed. Partner just leaves. His partner's had enough. He's tired. And he just leaves. And all of a sudden, you know, Mark Ruffalo's character is on his own.
Mm.
You know, his best friend and his partner's left him. So it's another breakdown of a relationship. We see it with Jake Gyllenhaal's character, you know, breakdown of the marriage. But there's a lot of that in this film.
What's interesting with Jake Gyllenhaal's character's breakdown of a marriage is that their first date is all related to Zodiac, which, again, shows is almost like obsessive, maybe slightly autistic approach to this, he's just like, this is all in my head. I can't get rid of this, right? But it's interesting how an entire marriage comes out of that. And for years, a decade almost, of just her going like, look, I'm always here to help you with this. But eventually it gets to the point, like, it's been too long now. Give it a break.
Or, when, you know, Zodiac comes on the TV and he's like, he's kind of looking at her, making small talk. It's just, yes, go and sit in front of the TV.
I love that bit because as Jake Gyllenhaal, like, tilts his head over to look at the TV, she does that too to block him and go like, what are you doing again?
Yeah,
and then you can say, oh, fine, go to the TV.
He's making small talk about peas. Oh, these peas are nice. Did you do something different, dear?
It's like, just go. I know you're fibbing. Just go over there.
Yeah.
It's clear with Mark Ruffalo's character, like his partner was his partner at the time. Obviously, it was a thing that was keeping him sort of grounded and not going as obsessive as he could be, because you were able to share the load. Basically, there's a lot of stress, and there's all this stress levels. It's like a man can't do it on his own, and when he finally gets the thing to do on his own, that, you know, there's even been the whole point of his character. Eventually, he was almost arrested for forging an entire letter, just so he can keep the case going, or to keep it in the public interest, so that he has something to do.
Well, I mean, if you look at the final third of the film, where he's helping Robert Graysmith, and he's basically revealing all this information. He's saying, I cannot advise you to talk to such and such. I cannot advise you to go over here and look at this, you know, piece of evidence. Because I think he's desperate again for this resolution. You know, even if this nobody, this cartoonist from the paper solves it, then it's been solved and it's put to bed, and he can, you know, again, it's affecting his marriage as well. You know, when he gets suspended, doesn't he? You know, that's affecting his relationship. So, I mean, he's going against what he should do as a police officer, and he's trying to get this nobody to just get it done.
Yeah.
Get it over with.
And in a weird way, his character does get a little resolution, because at the very end, there's a fantastic scene in a diner, which I adore, that scene in the diner, where Jake Gyllenhaal literally goes in the middle of the night, knocking at his door, saying, I have found the missing link. And obviously Mark Ruffalo is about to kill him because, like, you won't be able to build the night. You have been bugging me. You've actually put me in suspension. You have been kind of the reason why all this bad stuff happened. At the very end, despite the fact that this is all hearsay, he goes along with it. He goes for breakfast and tells him all the bits. And it's like, so almost saying, like, you know what? You were right in the first place. It was the original guy.
Yeah. Well, there's a wonderful moment, isn't there, where Jake Gyllenhaal is saying, there's this, there's that. And for everything he says, Mark Ruffalo just knocks it back. No, that was circumstantial. We never found any proof of that. But then there's one moment where Jake Gyllenhaal says something and there's this realization from Mark Ruffalo going, wow, that was him. Mm. We had him.
And you had him about a decade ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Look at this stuff side by side, Dave. All right. Okay. Arthur Lee Allen and the Zodiac, their timelines. When was the first murder in Vallejo?
Christmas 1968.
8 months before that, Allen is fired for molesting his students, and his family discovers that he's a pedophile. Now, when do the letters begin?
July 69.
After the murder of Darlene Farron, and they continue until you go to see him at work. Now, after that, do any of the letters contain swatches of Paul Stein's shirt? No, because he dumped him because he got scared because he knew that you were onto him. So when's the next letter from Zodiac?
Not until January of 1974.
He is silent for 3 years. Then in 74, he feels comfortable again because everybody's moved off Allen as a suspect. And what do we get? Three new letters from Zodiac in January, May, and July in 74.
But then the letters stop.
What happens to Allen?
He's arrested. January 1975, they send him to Atascadero. We don't get another letter from Zodiac the entire time he's there.
When is he released?
August 77.
Allen gets out, he types you an apology, and then what? We get our first new Zodiac letter in 4 years.
Okay. Zodiac had to have known Darlene Farron, right?
Yes, because of the phone calls on the night of her murder.
Because of the Vallejo file, we know that Darlene knew a man named Lee?
Yes.
So all coincidence aside, Robert, how can you be sure that Lee Allen is a Lee from this file? Now, Vallejo is a small town, but it's not that small. How do you put the two of them together?
This is a case that's covered both Northern and Southern California, with victims and suspects spread over hundreds of miles. Would you agree?
Yes.
Darlene Farron worked at the Vallejo House of Pancakes on the corner of Tennessee and Carroll. Arthur Lee Allen lived in his mother's basement on Fresno Street. Door to door, that is less than 50 yards.
Is that true?
I've walked it.
Jesus Christ.
There's one thing I do want to say about Mark Ruffalo. Mm. That decade, and this might sound a little bit silly to some of your listeners, that decade is when I started to realize who Mark Ruffalo was as an actor.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, that's the guy from Eternal Sunshine. That's that actor. Oh, wow. You know, and I started to make that link. I mean, I'm sorry to mention Marvel again, but, you know, before he became the Hulk,
yeah,
you know, he was doing all this fantastic work. And I love that period. I mean, I'm not sure what year Collateral is Collateral in the noughties. Michael Mann film.
Yeah, noughties as well.
Yeah. So he plays another great cop role. But yeah, I mean, look at, you know, Rob Downey Jr. and Mark Ruffalo in that period. Some fantastic roles, some fantastic acting.
They were trying things out. They were being meaty. They were going like, you know what, I want to do these things that really stand out as a character. And yeah, you're right. I'd actually argue that this is the best I've seen Mark Ruffalo in a while that isn't very sort of either superhero-y or very generic.
It's or romantic. Schlock romantic.
He's been in a lot of those. He was in a lot of those before this time. And actually, speaking of, just to throw in the little Marvel stint, it's kind of interesting that the three main actors in this movie have all now starred in Marvel movies. I think it basically is what, if you were a great actor in the 2000s, at some point you will be in a Marvel movie.
We just need John Lynch now. The guy that plays Arthur Lee Allen.
I have no idea what he's doing.
He can play, he'd be in the Fantastic Four. He can be the Thing.
Oh, he'd be great. But yeah, wonderful
stuff.
I don't
know if do you want to talk about just John Lynch very briefly? Because his performance in there. I mean, you know, we have got some great serial killer, psychotic performances, you know, in movie history. But he's the antithesis of the Hannibal Lecter performance. You know, the final interview they have with him when they drag him out of work,
yeah,
and they bring him into the canteen, and he just talks like you know, a normal guy. You know, he's just answering questions, and he's, you know, he's sat there with his legs crossed, and he's fiddling with his watch, and but it's just occasionally it'll drop a little clangor, a little, you know, in answer to the question, which will make the police sit up and go, hang on a minute. You know, when he mentions the deadliest game, basically hunting mankind. Yeah. But it's such a great performance, because I say it comes across just so natural and so normal, in inverted commas, but then occasionally he'll just drop something.
And you notice there's moments in that performance where everything's just surprisingly subtle, but you're sitting there going, huh. He's doing something with his watch. Huh? He's doing something with his foot. Ah, he's pausing just a little bit. It's a masterclass on how to sort of be, to have everything out on the table, but no one to almost realize it, except Mark Ruffalo's character, say, like, this is clearly something up with him. But his performance is outstanding in that scene.
Yeah. When he says, I look forward to the day when police officers aren't called pigs. And he just comes out with it. He just says it. And they all go, okay.
There's so many clues dropped in that entire thing, almost. Because it's like, wait a minute. If it's almost as if it's like, obviously at the end of the day, sitting there going like, well, actually, we didn't tell you half of this stuff. So how are you dropping this in if we're not telling you that, you know, and blah, blah, blah. Is it opinion or did you actually write that down? And it's...
But he never gives himself away, you know. You know, there's only thing that they could slap the cuffs off.
The informant notified us that you made certain statements 11 months prior to the first Zodiac murder. If they're true, they're quite incriminating. Do you recall having any such conversation?
No.
Have you ever read or heard anything about the Zodiac?
When it was first in the paper, but I didn't follow it after those first reports.
Why not?
Too morbid. I told all this to the other officer.
Which other officer?
From Vallejo.
Do you remember his name?
No, but it was right after the murder at the lake.
And what did you tell this officer?
I told him that I'd gone to Salt Point that weekend to skin dive, that I was alone, but I met a couple there. I have their names at home if you want them.
That would be great, Arthur.
Lee.
What?
Lee. Nobody calls me Arthur. Also, that day when I came home, my neighbor saw me. It was around 4, but I forgot to tell the other officer that.
Neighbor's name?
Bill White. He died a week or so afterwards. Heart attack, so I didn't think to call to follow up. The knives I had in my car with the blood on them, that blood came from a chicken that I killed for dinner. What? I had knives in my car that weekend. Maybe Bill saw them and called the other officer on me.
Well, we'll be checking in on that. Let me ask you something else. Were you ever in Southern California at any time in 1966?
Is this about the Riverside killing?
Yes.
Well, I guess I was there around that time. I used to go down there a lot. I liked the auto races.
Foreman says that you're ambidextrous.
No, that's untrue.
You can't write with both hands.
My teachers tried to make me when I was a kid, but I couldn't. I'm left-handed.
He also said that you made statements about killing school children.
That is horrible. That's a horrible thing to say.
So you aren't angry about being fired from Valley Springs for touching your students?
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
This feels very much like some of the interview scenes he would later master in Mindhunter. Like, there's some, like, talking to some of the serial killers in Mindhunter, they almost follow the way it's been picked out and performed and maybe directed by Fincher. It's not like going, this is how you perform that sense of being like your hands on, you know, being that person who gives all the clues but doesn't. That kind of, that interrogation approach was almost, by that point in Mindhunter, I'm sitting there going like, This is the best way to ever do an interrogation scene of any kind. The way it's edited, the way it's shot, the way the actors are performing, it's wonderful. And here, again, like I stated from the beginning, it's the blueprint, and it's almost a perfect blueprint. You could just show that scene and saying, this is Fincher at his most point of how he does these movies from this point onwards.
I think it's a confidence thing. I think he's starting, you said right at the beginning of this interview, you know, he's starting to find his feet, but I think it's a confidence thing. It's confidence in his filmmaking and how he wants to tell that story. You know, is I can do it. You know, I'm passionate about this subject matter, and I can tell it like this. It doesn't need to be all guns blazing. You know, we've got to hunt this serial killer, and he's going to be here at 10:35, and you know, get the sharpshooters, you know, on top of the buildings. It's not that kind of film.
It's not that at all.
I think that's a confidence thing. It's a confidence thing, you know, of being able to tell a story in that way.
So by that point, are we saying at the end of it, really, that David Fincher at this point in time is now confident in his ability as a director, as a filmmaker, and saying that this is, again, almost from the very beginning, from the way he selected the shots, performance, everything else, he sat there going and realizing this is all him. This is the most him. This is him out on the table and hoping that everyone likes it.
We haven't talked about some of the killings.
Yes, let's talk about the murders.
So there's one murder which... I can't remember the names of the people that were killed, so excuse me. But there's one scene, it's in the park, when there's the couple on the picnic rug.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just having a picnic, and you know, the girl notices there's someone standing by the tree.
Yes.
And the guy's like, oh, it's fine. He's probably just, you know, just hanging around. And then she's like, oh no, he's coming over. And it's all very, very polite and very relaxed. Tie your hands. Don't look at me. Lie face down. And then when the actual horrific moment comes, basically he stabs the guy in the back.
Yeah.
It's not glorified or anything like that. I think it's only one shot. It stays on one shot of the guy lying down and just of him, excuse the expression, being penetrated from behind. And he's just stab. And there's something about that which I find, by definition of the word, horrific. You know, it's not jazzed up or anything like that. It's... I don't even think there's any music.
No, it's most... I remember this as only just screams and shouting. Yeah. And the shots are... You don't see a lot of the stabbing. There's only one point where you see sort of a few shots of the woman being stabbed in the stomach, but it's like for a second. Yeah. Everything else is looking at the expression and the dying look in their eyes as the blood flows and rushes out.
But it's painful, you know. It's not a, you know, stab, oh, and this person and dies. It's lingering, you know. It's this... You can almost imagine it's this small knife. Yeah. I don't know if I'm just imagining that. It's just like, just, you know, it's something which is quite drawn out and brutal, and you know, the way Fincher can just examine a moment like that and not make it sensational.
And it's quite interesting, actually, that all the other murders are sort of similar-ish in a way, where they just kind of have a long build-up and almost like... Well, with the picnic scene, is more intentional, where it's, like I said, it's almost polite, and it's very... Personally, I find that quite confusing. Comes in like, we're all going along with this, are we? But no, there's no... In most movies, in most horror movies, at least in horror films, at least, or slasher films, this would be running. They'll be screaming. They'll be, you know, there'll be the big slasher killer coming in with a machete. This is just like, tie your hands, please. Do this, please. Which is more... Yeah. Which is a different kind of terror, because you're now going along the ideas, okay, there's a person with authority here. He has a gun. It's like, okay, we're going to do this. Okay, we're going to follow along and see what happens. And
They have a conversation. The guy goes, leave us out here. We're going to freeze to death.
Somebody else is here.
It is a public park.
I think he's watching us.
Well, we're very good looking.
Where'd he go? Went behind that tree.
All right, so he's taking a leak.
We just got coming towards us. Oh my God, he has a gun.
Don't move. I want your money and your car keys.
Okay. We're not going to do anything, okay? We're going to cooperate. Just tell me what you want us to do. You know, I might be able to help you. Even more than you might think.
He's a sociology major.
Pre-law.
Don't get up. I want her to tie you up.
Okay.
Don't get any ideas.
I'm not.
I killed a guard escaping from prison in Montana.
I'm not doing anything, okay?
I'm not afraid to kill again.
Then when the hurdy-gurdy man came singing songs.
And then all the other murders, there's a few scenes of the murders I found quite interesting. And the one I remember the most, even though it's not technically a murder, is the one where we got, I think it's Kathleen and her baby, where she gets that scene where, you know, the car breaks down and then has to be picked up by the person. I found that scene incredibly tense, and I actually was starting to get a bit nervous, because when they do agree to get into the car with him, and we know who it is at this point. We know because, well, we don't see their face. It's great, brilliant. Every time, even in that scene where in the park, he's all either dressed in black or in silhouette. So it's wonderfully shot. We never get a full confirmation on who the Zodiac Killer is, because we don't know. We still don't know. But it's brilliant, because by the time she gets into the car, there's a scene bit where he almost feels a bit surprised, because I didn't know you had a baby. And she goes and says, oh, is that be okay? And he says, the more the merrier, which is downright terrifying when you know who it is.
Yeah, and then just the aftermath, you know, of throwing the baby out of the window.
Are you okay?
Yeah. Yeah, we're fine.
Must have been worse than I thought. I can give you a lift to a service station.
Okay.
I didn't know you had a baby.
Oh, is that okay?
The more the merrier.
It's terrifying, because we don't see that action. It cuts to black, and we cut later, where just a trucker in a car just sees this woman screaming in terror. And it's like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, because he can't go over and touch her. She's hysterical.
Yeah, it's a wonderful scene for me. It's the most tense scene in the movie, in terms of, because we know where it's building up to. Some of the other murders, such as the cab driver and the teenage couple at the beginning, those are surprisingly quick, and they're done purposefully. Like, it's like, you know, like, oh, there's someone here. Can I help you? Bam. Two shots to the head.
Imagine someone standing in the video shop. I'm showing my age now, but standing in the video shop. Oh, there's a serial killer movie. Oh, look at this one. You know. Oh, it's about the Zodiac Killer, and there's only four murders in there, something like that. And
four
like
murders.
You said, all very short
in the first hour, and they don't last anything longer than a couple of minutes each. I always end this podcast with something called the elevator pitch. It's very, very simple, okay? If you're going to introduce this movie to someone who's never seen it before in a couple of sentences, how would you do it?
If you want to watch a movie which shows you how to live as a human being and what not to do as a human being and how to find closure and how to not find closure... watch this movie. It's not your balls to the wall slasher serial killer horror film. There's more going on there. It's about life. It's about life, like you said. It's you know, all those decades. It's an entire lifetime.
It's 25 goddamn years in 3 hours. It's so impressive.
Yeah.
You know, it's so impressive that in 3 hours we've gone through literally 3 different decades. Absolutely wonderful. It was an absolute treat, this film. Good. Honest to Christ. And I have to thank you for that.
Get it on Blu-ray.
Get on Blu-ray. And that was our review of David Fincher's Zodiac, a master's blueprint and one that deserves a second stab at. It was great to have Chris Chambers on to sort of guide me through some of the better character pieces and to analyze the actor performance. If you want to find out more about this subject, I would highly recommend looking at Chris's YouTube channel, Organic Acting. Link can be found in the description below. So what do you think? What other underrated films from well-known directors would you want me to review on the podcast? Feel free to write your suggestions on our social media, and maybe, just maybe, we can reopen another cold case. And with that, this film essay is closed. And we'll return soon for another not-so-trash review. See you all next time, cinephiles.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode and hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it around with movie lovers you know, maybe add a star rating or write a good review. All of this helps with the algorithm and provides us with more opportunities to reach the ears to a whole new bunch of bad film fanatics. Want to find out more about us? Then head over to our socials where we provide sneak peeks and up-to-date news on everything nostalgic and trashy. You can find our Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter pages in the description, so please follow us. See you next time, cinephiles.